Side 17, The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Continuing on page 490. Dawson glanced into the dispatcher's booth and saw that all of his incoming lines were lighted.
Andy, the situation's still developing. I gotta...
I know, Ferguson said. You've got to go talk to crazy people. I've got to call the Attorney General's office in Augusta and talk to other crazy people. Jim Tierney's the best AG we've had in Maine since I put on this uniform. And do you know where he is this gay day, Smokey?
No.
On vacation, Ferguson said with a laugh that was slightly wild. First one since he took the job. The only man in the administration that might be able to understand this nuttiness is camping with his family in Utah. Fucking Utah. Nice, huh?
Nice.
What the fuck's going on?
I don't know.
Any other casualties?
A forest ranger from Newport died,
Dawson said reluctantly.
Who?
Henry Amberson.
What? Henry? Christ.
Ferguson felt as if he had been hit hard in the pit of the stomach. He had known Henry Amberson for 20 years. The two of them hadn't been best friends, nothing like it, but they had played some cribbage together when times were slow, done a little fly fishing. Their families had taken dinner together. Henry. Jesus, Henry Amberson. And Tierney was in fucking Utah.
Was he in one of the jeeps they sent out?
Yeah.
He had a pacemaker, you know, and...
What? What? Ferguson took a step toward Smokey as if to shake him.
What?
The guy driving the jeep apparently radioed into three that it exploded in Amberson's chest.
Oh, my Jesus Christ.
It's not sure yet, Dawson said quickly. Nothing is. The situation is still developing.
How could a pacemaker explode?
Ferguson asked softly.
I don't know.
It's a joke, Ferguson said flatly. Either some weird joke or something like that radio show that time, War of the World. Timidly, Smokey said,
I don't think it's a joke. Or a hoax.
Neither do I, Ferguson said. He headed for his office and the telephone.
Fucking Utah,
he said softly. And then left Smokey Dawson to try to keep up with the increasingly unbelievable information that was coming in from the area of which Bobby Anderson's farm was the center. 3. Ferguson would have called the AG's office first if Jim Tierney hadn't been in fucking Utah. Since he was, he put it off long enough to make a quick call to David Bright at the Bangor Daily News.
David? It's Andy. Listen,
We've got reports there's a fire in Haven, Andy. Maybe a big one. Have you got that?
Yeah, we do.
David, I can't take you over there. The information you gave me checks out, though. Fire crews and recon people can't get into town. They get sick. We've lost a forest ranger. A guy I knew. I heard... He shook his head.
Forget what I heard. It's too goddamn crazy to be true.
Bright's voice was excited.
What was it?
Forget it. But you say firemen and rescue crews are getting sick? Recon people. We don't know yet if anyone needs rescuing or not. Then there's the shit about the fire trucks and jeeps. Vehicles seem to stop running when they get close to or into Haven.
What?
You heard me.
You mean it's like the pulse?
Pulse? What pulse? He had a crazy idea that Bright was talking about Henry's pacemaker, that he had known all along.
It's the phenomenon that's supposed to follow big nuclear bangs. Cars stop dead.
Christ. What about radios?
Them too.
But your friend said...
All over the band, yes, hundreds.
Can I at least quote you on the sick firemen and the rescue people, the vehicles stopping?
Yeah.
As Mr. Source, Mr. Informed Source.
When did you first hear?
I don't have time to do the Playboy interview, David. Your Leandro went to Maine Med Supplies for air?
Yes.
He thought it was the air, Ferguson said, more to himself than to Bright.
That's what he thought.
Andy. You know what else stops cars dead, according to the reports we get from time to time?
What?
UFOs. Don't laugh, it's true. People who sight flying saucers at close range when they're in their cars or planes almost always say their motors just drop dead until the thing goes away.
He paused.
Remember the doctor who crashed his plane in Newport a week or two ago?
More of the world.
Ferguson thought again.
What a pile of crap. But Henry Amberson's pacemaker had... what? Exploded? Could that possibly be true? He would make it his business to find out. That you could take to the bank. "I'll be talking to you, Davy," Torgerson said and hung up. It was 3:15. In Haven, the fire which had begun at the old Frank Garrick farm had been burning for over an hour and was now spreading toward the ship in a widening crescent. 4. Torgerson called Augusta at 3:17 p.m. At that time, two sedans with a total of 6 investigators in them were already northbound on I-95. Fire Station 3 had called the AG's office at 2:26 p.m. and the Derry State Police Barracks at 2:49. The Derry report included the first jagged element, the crash of the Unity pumper, the death of a forest ranger who appeared to have been shotgunned by his own pacemaker. At 1:30 p.m. Mountain Time, a Utah State Police cruiser stopped at the campground where Jim Tierney and his family were staying. The trooper informed him there was an emergency in his home state. What sort of emergency? That, the trooper had been told, was information obtainable strictly on a need-to-know basis. Tierney could have called Derry, but Torgerson in Cleves Mills was a guy he knew and trusted. Right now, he wanted more than anything else to talk to someone he trusted. He felt a slow, sinking dread in his gut. A feeling that it had to be Maine Yankee, had to be something with the state's only nuclear plant. Had to be. Only something that big could have caused this kind of extraordinary response almost a whole country away. The trooper patched him through. Torgerson was both delighted and relieved to hear Tierney's voice. At 1:37 p.m. Mountain Time, Tierney climbed into the shotgun seat of the cruiser and said, "How fast does this go?" "Sir, this vehicle will go 130 miles an hour, and I am a Mormon, sir, and I am not afraid to drive it at that speed, sir, because I am confident that I will avoid hell, sir." "Prove it," Tierney said. At 2:03 p.m. Mountain Time, Tierney was in a Learjet with no markings but the U.S. flag on its tail. It had been waiting for him at a small private airfield near Cottonwood, the town of which Zane Grey wrote in Riders of the Purple Sage, the book which had been Roberta Anderson's favorite as a girl, the one which had perhaps set her course forever as a writer of westerns. The pilot was in mufti. "Are you Defense Department?" Tierney asked. The pilot looked at him with expressionless dark glasses. "Shop." It was the only word he spoke before, during, or after the flight. That was how the Dallas police entered the game. 5. Haven had been nothing but a wide place in the road, dreaming its life away comfortably off the major main tourist track. Now it had been noticed. Now people headed there in droves. Since they knew nothing of the anomalies that were being reported in ever-increasing numbers, it was only the growing pall of smoke on the horizon which drew them at first like moths to candle flames. It would be almost 7 o'clock that evening before the state police, with the help of the local National Guard unit, would be able to block off all the roads to the area, the minor ones as well as the major. By morning, the fire would become the greatest forest fire in Maine history. The brisk, easterly wind came up right on schedule, and once it did, there was no way the fire's running start could be overcome. The realization did not sink in all at once, but it did sink in. The fire might have burned unchecked, even if the day had been dead calm. You couldn't do much about a fire you couldn't get to, and the efforts to get near this one had unpleasant results. The spotter plane had crashed. A busload of National Guardsmen from Bangor ran off the road, struck a tree, and exploded when the driver's brain simply burst like a tomato loaded with a cherry bomb. All 70 weekend warriors died, but maybe only half of them in the crash. The rest died in a fruitless effort to crawl out of the poison belt. Unfortunately, the wind was blowing the wrong way, as Torgerson could have told them. The forest fire which had begun in burning woods had crisped half of Newport before firefighters could properly go to work. But by then they were strung too thin to do much good because the fire line was nearly 6 miles long. By 7 that evening, hundreds of people, some self-appointed firefighters, most your common garden variety homo rubberneckus, had poured into the area. Most promptly poured right back out again, faces white, eyes bulging, noses and ears jetting blood. Some came clutching their lost teeth in their hands like pitted pearls, and not a few of them died, not to mention the 100 or so hapless residents of eastern Newport who got a sudden dose of Haven when the wind turned brisk. Most of those died in their houses. Those who came to gawk and stayed to asphyxiate on the rotten air were found in or beside various roads, curled in fetal positions, hands clutched over their stomachs. Most, one GI later told the Washington Post, under the strict condition that he not be identified, looked like bloody human commas. Such was not the fate of Lester Moran, a textbook salesman who lived in a Boston suburb and spent most of his days on the highways of northern New England. Lester was returning from his annual late summer selling trip to the schools in the SADs, school administrative districts, of Aroostook County, when he saw smoke, a lot of it, on the horizon. This was at about 4:15 p.m. Lester diverted immediately. He was in no hurry to get back, being a bachelor and having no plans for the next 2 weeks or so, but he would have diverted even if the National Sales Conference had been slated to begin the next day with him as the principal speaker and his speech still unwritten. He couldn't have helped himself. Lester Moran was a fire freak. He had been one since earliest childhood. In spite of having spent the last 5 days on the road, in spite of a fanny that felt like a board and kidneys that felt like bricks after the constant jolting his sprung car had taken on the shitty roads of townships so small they mostly had map coordinates for names, Lester never thought twice. His weariness fell away. His eyes glowed with that preternatural light which fire chiefs from Manhattan to Moscow know and dread, the unholy excitement of the natural-born fire freak. They are the sort of people fire chiefs will, however, put to use if driven to the wall. 5 minutes ago, Lester Moran, who had applied to the Boston Fire Department at the age of 21 and been turned down because of the steel plate in his skull, had felt like a whipped dog. Now he felt like a man highballing on amphetamines. Now he was a man who would happily don an Indian pump, which weighed almost half as much as he did himself, and lug it on his back all night, breathing smoke the way some men breathe the perfume on the nape of a beautiful woman's neck, fighting the flames until the skin of his cheeks was cracked and blistered and his eyebrows were burned clean off. He exited the turnpike at Newport and burned up the road which led toward Haven. The plate in his head was the result of a hideous accident which had occurred when Moran was 12 and a junior high patrol boy. A car had struck him and thrown him 30 feet, where his flight had been interrupted by the obdurate brick wall of a furniture warehouse. He had been given last rites. His weeping parents had been told by the surgeon who operated on him that their son would likely die within 6 hours or remain in a coma for several days or weeks before succumbing. Instead, the boy had been awake and asking for ice cream before the end of the day. "I think it's a miracle," the boy's sobbing mother cried. "A miracle from God."
"Me too,"
said the surgeon who had operated on Lester Moran and who had looked at the boy's brain through a gaping hole in the poor kid's shattered skull. Now, closing in on all that delightful smoke, Lester began to feel a little sick to his stomach, but he chalked that up to excitement and then forgot all about it. The plate in his skull was, after all, nearly twice the size of the one in Jim Gardiner's. The absence of police, fire, or forestry department vehicles in the thickening murk he found both extraordinary and oddly exhilarating. Then he rounded a sharp curve and saw a bronze-colored Plymouth lying upside down in the left-hand ditch, its red dashboard flasher still pulsing. Written on the side was Derry F.D. Lester parked his old Ford wagon, got out, and trotted over to the wreck. There was blood on the steering wheel and the seat and the driver's side floor mat. There were droplets of blood on the windshield. All in all, quite a lot of blood. Lester stared at it, horrified, and then looked toward Haven. Dull red colored the base of the smoke now, and he realized he could actually hear the dull crackle of burning wood. It was like standing near the world's biggest open-hearth furnace, or as if the world's biggest open-hearth furnace had sprouted legs and was slowly approaching him. Next to that sound, next to the sight of that dull yet titanic red glow, the overturned dairy fire chief's car and the blood inside began to seem a good deal less important. Lester went back to his own car, fought a brief battle with his conscience, and won by promising himself he would stop at the first payphone he came to and call the state police in Cleves Mills. No, Derry. Like most good salesmen, Lester Moran carried a detailed map of his territory in his head, and after consulting it, he decided Derry was closer. He had to resist the yammering urge to goose the wagon up to its top speed, which was about 60 these days. He expected at every turn of the road to come upon sawhorses blocking the road, a confusion of crazily parked vehicles, The sound of CB radio squealing out messages at top gain, shouting men in hard hats, helmets, and rubber coats. It didn't happen. Instead of sawhorses and a boiling nest of activity, he came upon the overturned Unity pumper, cab broken off its body, the tank itself still spraying the last of its load. Lester, who was now breathing smoke as well as air that would have killed almost anyone else on Earth, stood on the soft shoulder, mesmerized by the limp white arm he saw dangling from the window of the pumper's amputated cab. Rivulets of drying blood ran erratic courses down the arm's white and vulnerable underside.
Something wrong here. Something a lot more wrong than just a wood fire. You got to get out, Les.
But instead he turned toward the fire again and was lost. The smoky taste in the air was stronger. The sound of burning was now not a crackle but a rolling thunder. The truth of it suddenly fell on him like a bucket of cement. No one was fighting this fire. No one at all. For some reason he couldn't understand. They either hadn't been able to get into the area or hadn't been allowed in. As a result, the fire was burning out of control, and with the freshening wind to help, it was growing like a radioactive monster in a horror movie. The idea made him ill with terror and excitement and sick, dark joy. It was bad to feel a thing like that last, but it was there, and it was impossible to deny. Nor was he the only one who had felt it. That dark joy had seemed to be a part of every firefighter he had ever bought a drink for, which was almost every firefighter he'd ever met since he flunked his own BFD physical. He fumbled and stumbled back to his car, started it with some difficulty, assuming that in his excitement he had probably almost flooded the damn dinosaur, boosted the air conditioner all the way up, and headed toward Haven again. He was aware that this was idiocy of the purest ray serene. He was, after all, not Superman, but a 45-year-old textbook salesman who was going bald and who was still a bachelor because he was too shy to ask women for dates. He was not just behaving in an idiotic fashion, either. Harsh as that judgment was, it was still a rationalization. The truth was he was behaving like a lunatic, and yet he could no more stop himself than a junkie can stop himself when he sees his fix cooking in the spoon. He couldn't fight it, but he could still go see it. And it would really be something to see, wouldn't it? Lester thought. Sweat was already rolling down his face, as if in anticipation of the heat ahead. Something to see. Oh, yeah. A forest fire that was for some reason being allowed to rage utterly out of control, as they had millions of years ago, when men were little more than a small tribe of hairless monkeys cowering in the twin cradles of the Nile and the Euphrates, and the great fires themselves were touched off by spontaneous combustion, strokes of lightning, or meteor falls instead of drunk hunters who didn't give a shit what they did with their cigarette butts. It would be a bright orange furnace, a firewall 90 feet high in the woods, across the clearings and gardens and hayfields that would race like a Kansas prairie fire in the 1840s, gobbling houses so swiftly they would implode from the sudden change in air pressure, as houses and factories had done during the World War II firebombings. He would be able to see the road he was on, this very road, disappearing into that furnace like a highway into hell. The tar itself, he thought, would first begin to run in sticky little rivulets, and then to burn. He stepped down harder on the gas and thought, how could you not go on? When you had a chance, a once-in-a-lifetime chance, to see something like that, how could you not? 6. I just don't know how I'm going to explain to my dad, is all, the main med supplies clerk said. He wished he had never argued 4 years ago for expanding their business to include rentals in the first place. His father had thrown that in his face after the old guy rented the flat pack and never returned it. And now all hell was breaking loose in Haven. The radio said it was a forest fire, and then went on to hint that even weirder things might be happening there. And he was betting he'd never see the flat pack he had rented that morning to the reporter with the thick glasses either. Now here were two more fellows, state troopers, no less, both big, and most unsettling of all, one about as black as a fellow could be, demanding not just one flat pack each, but 6 of them. You can tell your dad we requisitioned them, Torgerson said. I mean, you do provide respiration gear for firemen, don't you? Yes, and there's a forest fire in Haven, isn't there? Yes, then get them out here. I don't have time to bullshit. My father is gonna kill me, he wailed. That's all we got. Torgerson had met Claudel Weems pulling into the parking lot of the barracks just as Torgerson himself was pulling out. Claudel Wien, Maine's only black state trooper, was tall, not as tall as the late Monster Dugan, but a very respectable 6'4". Claudel Weems had one gold tooth in the front of his mouth, and when Claudel Weems moved very close to people, suspects, for instance, or reluctant clerks, and smiled, revealing that sparkling gold incisor, they became very nervous. Torgerson once asked Claudel Weems why this was, and Claudel Weems said he believed it was that old black magic, and then laughed until the glass in the barracks window seemed to tremble in its frame. Weems now leaned very close to the clerk and employed that old black magic that he wove so well. When they left Maine Med with the flat packs, the clerk was not really sure what had happened, except that the black fella had the biggest gold tooth he had ever seen in his life. 7. The toothless old man who had sold Leandro the T-shirt stood on his porch and watched expressionlessly as Torgerson's cruiser blasted by. When it was gone, he went inside and made a phone call to a number most people wouldn't have been able to reach. They would have heard the sirening sound, which had infuriated Ann Anderson instead. But there was a gadget on the back of the storekeeper's phone, and soon he was talking to an increasingly harried Hazel McCready. 8. So, Claudel Wien said cheerfully after craning his neck to look at the speedometer, I see we are driving at just over 90 miles an hour, and since the consensus is that you're probably the shittiest motor vehicle operator in the entire Maine State Police... What fucking consensus? Torgerson asked. My fucking consensus, Claudel Wien said. Anyway, that leads to a deduction. The deduction is that I will die very soon. I don't know if you believe in that bullshit about granting a doomed man's last request, but if you do, maybe you'd tell me what this is all about. If you can, before we receive our engine block implants, that is. Andy opened his mouth, then closed it again. No, he said. I can't, it's too nuts. Just this much. You may start to feel sick. If you do, put some of that canned air to you right away. Oh, Christ. Wien said. The air's been poisoned in Haven? I don't know, I think so. Oh, Christ, Wien said again. Who spilled what beans? Andy only shook his head. That's why no one's fighting the fire. The smoke boiled up from the horizon in a widening swath, mostly white so far, thank God. I don't know, I think so. Run one of the bands on the radio. Weems blinked as if he thought Torgerson might be crazy. Which band? Any band. So Weems began to run the police band, at first getting nothing but the confused, beginning to be frightened babble of cops and firemen who wanted to fight a fire and somehow couldn't get to where it was. Then, further down, they heard a request for backup units at the scene of a liquor store robbery. The address given was 117 Mystic Avenue, Medford. Weems looked at Andy. Jeepers creepers, Andy. I didn't know there was any Mystic Avenue in Medford. In fact, I didn't think there was any avenues at all in Medford. Couple of pulp roads, maybe. I think, Andy said, and his voice seemed to be coming to his own ears from very far away. That particular squeal is coming from Medford, Massachusetts. 9. 200 yards over the Haventown line, Lester Moran's motor died. It did not cough. It did not hitch. It did not backfire. It just died, quietly and without fanfare. He got out without bothering to switch off the key. The steady crackle of the fire filled the whole world, it seemed. The air temperature had gone up at least 20 degrees. The wind was carrying the heavy smoke toward him, but up, so the air was breathable. It still had a hot, acrid taste. Here on the left and right were wide fields, Clarendon land on the right, Rival land on the left. It rose in a long, undulating slope toward the woods. In those woods, Lester could see steadily brightening winks of red and orange light. Smoke poured up from them in a torrent which was steadily darkening. He could hear the thumping explosions of hollow trees imploding as the fire sucked the oxygen out of them like marrow from old bones. The wind was not straight into his face, but close enough. The fire was going to break out of the woods and into the field in minutes, seconds maybe. Its rush down to where he stood, face red and running with sweat, might be lethally quick. He wanted to be back in his car before that happened. It would start, of course it would. Old Gal had never failed him yet. And piling up distance between himself and that red, oncoming beast.
Go, then. Go, for Christ's sake. You've seen it. Now go.
Thing was, he really hadn't seen it. He'd felt its heat, seen it wink its eyes and fume smoke from its dragon's nostrils.
But he really hadn't seen the fire.
But then he did. It came out of Luther Raval's west field in a pounce. The main fire front bore on into Big Engine Woods, but this side now broke free of the forest. The trees massed at the far end of the field were no match for the red animal. They seemed for a moment to grow blacker as the light behind them was turned up. Yellow to orange, orange to glare red. Then they simply swept into flame. It happened in an instant. For a moment, Lester could see their tops, and then they were gone too. It was like the act of some fabulous prestidigitator, the sort of magician Hilly Brown had once wanted to be with all his heart and soul. The fire line was before him, 80 feet high and eating trees as Lester Moran stood mesmerized, mouth gaping before it. Flames began to run down the slope of the field. Now the smoke began to rafter around him, thicker, choking. He began to cough.
Get out, for Christ's sake, get out.
Yes, now he would, now he could. He had seen it, and it was every bit as spectacular as he had expected it would be. But it was a beast. And what a right-thinking man did when confronted with a beast was run. Run just as fast and far as he could. All living things did it. All living things. Lester backed halfway to his car and then stopped. All living things. Yes. All living things ran before a forest fire. The old patterns were suspended. The coyote ran beside the rabbit. But there were no rabbits. And no coyotes coming down that field. There were no birds in the gunmetal-colored sky. No one here but him. No birds or animals running from the fire meant there were none in the woods. The overturned FD car, the blood everywhere. The pumper wrecked in the woods, the bloody arm. What's going on here? His mind screamed. He didn't know, but he knew he was putting on those fabled boogie shoes. He pulled the door open and then looked back one final time. What he saw rising out of that great pillar of smoke jerked a scream from him. He drew in smoke, coughed on it, screamed again. Something, some huge something, was rising out of the smoke like the greatest whale in creation, slowly breaching. Smoke-hazed sunlight gleamed mellowly on its side, and still it came up, came up, came up, and there was no sound except for the awkward thunder-crunched strides of the fire. Up and up and up. His neck craned to follow its slow, impossible progress, and so he never saw the small, queer thing which came out of the smoke and trundled smartly down the road toward him. It was a red wagon. It had belonged to little Billy Fannin at the beginning of the summer. In the center of the wagon was a platform. On the platform was a Benson brush trimmer, little more than a power blade at the end of a long pole. The blade was controlled by a pistol grip control. A sales tag reading, "Cut up a storm with your Benson," still fluttered from the top of the pole. It was on a moving gimbal, and looked a bit like the jutting prow of an absurd ship. Lester was cringing against his car and staring up into the sky when the gadget's EEG sensor, which had begun life as a digital meat probe, triggered the brush trimmer's electronic starter, a modification the Benson designers had never considered. The blade shrieked into life, the small gas motor howling like a hurt cat. Lester turned and saw something like a fishing pole with teeth coming at him. He cried out and ducked toward the rear of his car. What's going on here? His mind screamed. What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What? The brush trimmer swung on its gimbal, seeking Lester, following his brain waves, which it sensed as neat little pulses, not much different from radar blips. The brush trimmer was not very bright. Its brain came from a programmable toy called the Terrible Tracker Tank, but it was bright enough to stay homed in on the low electrical output of Lester Moran's own brain, his battery, one might say. Lester screamed as Billy Fannin's wagon trundled toward him. Get away! Get away! Instead, the wagon seemed to leap at him. Lester Moran, his heart hammering wildly in his chest, zigged. The brush trimmer zigged with him. Lester Moran tried to zag, and then a huge, slowly moving shadow fell over him, and he looked up in spite of himself. He just couldn't help it. His feet tangled in each other, and the brush cutter pounced. Its whirling blade chewed into Lester's head. It was still working on him when the fire engulfed both it and its victim.